every Tuesday night, 8 to 10 p.m. on 50 Years Ago This Week on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hi, everybody. You're listening to Into the Dark on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you like the shows you're listening to on this station, please do consider contributing to the money we need to keep all these fancy digital what's-its going at RadioFreeBrooklyn.com/pledge. See you kids on the back end of the theme music. Stay tuned for Into the Dark.
Skeptic among believers and the believer among skeptics.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Who are the witches?
Magic, necromancy, and witchcraft.
Wake up! They're all about you! All around you!
They're not always
evil. The often erotic work of the witch.
You think what the witch coming back to life?
The journalist with an inside knowledge of witchcraft.
It's a sex thing deep down, of course.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Dark, the show that takes you to every witchy where and when you've ever wondered about. We have a really good show for you today. I'm going to be interviewing Fred Jennings in the studio. Fred Jennings is this fascinating fixture of magic and witchcraft here in New York City, particularly in Brooklyn. But before we get to that, I wanted to mention one thing. So this weekend I interviewed artist and occultist Manny Price. And that was a pre-recorded interview, not going to be on this episode, going to be on the next episode. But between now and then, there is a show that she is participating in that I wanted you to know about. So just so you know, Manny Price's art, including, will be among the many artists featured at Psychedelic Horror Show on October 27th at 7 p.m. at Holy Apostles Gallery, 9th Avenue. And it won't just be Manny Price, though it will be Manny Price, who's done some really fabulous and sometimes controversial occult-themed art. There's also going to be... let's see here, Peter Westerman, Calyptus, Jeff Logan, and someone called the Vigilante, like a vigilante for an orifice. And I think that's fantastic. You should check that out. But now that we've gotten through that important note, which I'll probably bring up at some point later in the show, we also have Fred Jennings in the studio, who just sat down in front of a microphone, and I think it's microphone number 3. Hey, Fred, say hi.
Hey, can you hear me all right?
Oh my God, it is the right microphone. Fantastic. Okay, so... Fred Jennings, I'm going to throw a bunch of words at you right now, and you can feel free to accept them or say no to them, but chaos magician, alchemist, scholar of the occult, practitioner of the occult, cyber lawyer, which I know sounds like you're a lawyer on the internet, but it's more that you're, I mean, you are, you've been there, you've been to the internet, you've seen what's to be had there, but also you just came back from the Occult Humanities Conference.
I did, yeah. That was earlier today and all of yesterday as well.
And you were vending on behalf of Catlan Books, I'm understanding.
Correct, yeah. We had a table there.
How did that go? Was that fun?
It was great. It's always a fantastic crowd. I think it's always a pleasure dealing with people who are sort of in the scholarly and academic side of the occult. And this is an event run by people who are both academics and practitioners. So it ends up being a wonderful mix of sort of knowledge and practice that I honestly, even in other sort of conference scenarios, I've never seen anything quite like it.
That's really fantastic. And that's a yearly thing, yeah?
It's usually yearly, yeah.
Okay, so everyone, check it out next year, I guess. Because it's done. This is the end of it, yeah?
It's ending in about an hour and a half, and then I think there's an evening musical performance.
Ooh, okay. So when you're done listening to the show, why not go to that, maybe? So there's a lot of stuff I wanted to talk to you about. And in fact, I decided to in honor of you, do my first randomized chaos interview where I've written out a bunch of topics on cards. Well, not cards, pieces of paper, because I don't have that kind of budget. But there's one thing I did want to make sure we talked about. So before we do that,
okay,
one thing. So you are one of the co-founders of Catlan Books.
Correct.
Among... two other people, and I was so as I was like digging into the trenches of the internet looking for information about you to ask you questions about, I noticed something, and I was curious about it just on a personal level, but since I'm talking to you and asking you questions, I figured we'd just talk about it.
Go for it.
So there's a rash of articles about Catlan from 2013, and in most of those articles the primary spokesperson is one of the other co-founders, a fellow named Philip English. Mm-hmm. And he said something that, I mean, I don't know if it's true or not. It doesn't jive with my understanding of you, but I, of course, met you years later, where he said of you, he's not interested in the occult, said English. He just thinks it's a good business decision. And I'm curious because looking back at, like, you know, I know you as an occultist because I met you in, like, 2016. But, like, even, say, from 2015 when you did a talk at Catland called Know Your Rights, spelled with an, I mean, they're both spelled with an I, R-I-T-E-S, about sort of the legal aspects of magic and how the law can be applied to those situations. It seemed like you were maybe less comfortable at the beginning offering yourself as someone with magical expertise as opposed to someone with more of a kind of temporal side.
Yeah, there's a couple pieces to that.
Okay.
I think that quote in the article is a little bit foreshortened from what I think was actually said during that interview. But that was also a period in time where I was working in a much more sort of publicly visible legal role. And so, yeah, at the time with that article, I was a little more hesitant about being as public as I have been, you know, in more recent years about sort of my background or my knowledge in that area.
Going on a radio show, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that was a big part of it. I was also working overseas at the time and was unsure how, you know, working overseas at the time in a somewhat politically touchy location, and wasn't sure how that would go over, just in a abundance of paranoia, wasn't sure how that would go over with potential local authorities or immigration.
Fair enough. Can you say which place you were working in?
So in my lawyery, more lawyery role, I was the first person doing direct interview research on juveniles in the Palestinian justice system.
Oh, wow.
So I was
okay.
Working based out of Ramallah, but working all over the West Bank, doing on-site interviews with clients and former clients of a public defense office over there.
Okay. I can totally understand then why you would want to keep as kind of even blank a slate as possible.
Precisely. Yeah. It wasn't so much about, you know, specific paranoia about being labeled an occultist, but just wanting to keep a very low profile at the time.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. I'm curious because, like, I think of you as both a scholar and a practitioner, and I'm wondering which came first. Because you seem to know a ton about a lot of things. Like, it's sort of like, is this, in my interactions with you, it just sort of like, it'll pop up that you're kind of the person to talk to about something out of nowhere. But, like, how did this start?
So I think I was a practitioner first, if we're drawing sort of a nice clean line between the two. I'm not sure there exactly is one. But I'd been interested in the occult for a really long time. I think the very first contact I had with it in any sort of formal sense was I picked up a copy of Craig's Modern Magic.
Okay.
When I was just not for any reason other than it had a cover that 10-year-old me thought looked cool.
Okay, so you were really young at the beginning of this.
Yeah, and that was not, I don't date my sort of start of my practice to that point in time, but that was the first time I sort of had a book in my hands on this stuff and was reading into and looking at sort of what this whole world looked like.
Okay. And from there, where did you really start getting invested in this?
So I had a few very close friends when I was about 13 who I'd known them for about a year and knew that this was something they were into.
Mm.
And it happened very organically. It just sort of came up one day that was also something I was interested in, and we all had sort of a slightly older figure who was kind of a mentor for the three of us or four of us at the time. And so that having this kind of close group to work with very early on was a big part of kind of my formative introduction to the occult.
Okay. And when did you... So, I mean, when it comes to, like, ritual, I've noticed you are someone who I think is very creative and improvisational with those ritual aspects. I mean, we've talked about, like, for example, the kit you made to hex Donald Trump, I think it was.
The anti-fascist spell kit.
The anti-fascist spell kit, sorry, yes. Which I think contained a sigil you made yourself, a candle, an incantation or sort of a ritual that you had sort of designed.
Yeah, it was probably the most complex sort of kit or pre-prepared thing I've put together. But it had a dressed candle that is a candle that was sort of partially melted in which was rolled certain herbs and mixtures, and then it had a sigil I'd put together and sort of hand calligraphed. And two pieces of instructions, one that was sort of an operative instruction, here's what you do, here is the sort of step-by-step quote-unquote recipe for the ritual, and then an explanatory piece as well that was more of a, here's why you're doing it.
That's really fascinating.
I think, you know, one of the things that I draw heavily from chaos magic is this notion that, you know, if magic is about personal liberation, rote study and rote recitation of a certain form isn't particularly liberating. You know, to make the magic your own, you have to put your own work and creativity into it. So it would have felt sort of deeply antithetical to the purpose of an anti-fascist spell kit to offer an instruction booklet that said, do exactly this and don't question why.
Fantastic. And that's interesting because, like, I was wondering, when you founded Catlan, was there, how much of that was an educational sort of liberational idea? Like, what was the motivation between starting this witchcraft shop?
So the common theme for all three of us founders was, we came to the city not for Catland reasons and at slightly separate times. But we'd all had the common experience of coming from a smaller town and figuring, oh, it's New York. There's going to be a huge occult community and a massive network of people to meet and know and places to go and sort of a community around different traditions. And each of us had the experience of coming to the city and finding that there were one or two spots, maybe, but they were very small. And some of them were not particularly welcoming if you weren't kind of already within their very specific practice area.
Yeah.
And so we'd all sort of separately come to this idea of, man, it's weird that there's not that community hub space in New York, really. And talking to some older occultists in the city, since then, it sounds like there used to be places like that. The Magical Child was something that was mentioned to us many, many times in kind of formulating the Catland plan.
Hmm.
So a lot of the intent was, you know, on a sort of more activist sense, having seen what had happened to other parts of Brooklyn and lower Manhattan in decades past, said, well, you know, let's try and plant a foothold here and keep at least this little chunk of Brooklyn weird. And the other part of it was seeing this lack of a kind of community meeting space or event space for the, you know, various spiritual and esoteric groups in the city.
That's one of the best things about Catland as someone who has slowly been drawn into its tentacles. Just that idea of having a space for other people. And now we're going to commence the randomized part of the interview, excellent, which will be hopefully the rest of it, I think. I provided that, like, these cards are not too boring, but there are a lot of them. So
this is awfully fitting. I was talking to a Discordian friend just earlier today and digging casually through the Book of Eris. So,
okay. So first thing here, how did this start? We just talked about that. Okay, never mind. That's the question I already asked. This is actually proving rather difficult. So alchemy. What is alchemy generally, but what is alchemy specifically to you? What does it matter? Why does it matter to you? But what? Why should it matter to, I don't know, the kids who listen to the hip hop and they ride their scooters and they drink their Sunny D or whatever?
Sure. So alchemy is not a major part of my practice, but it's one that I, mostly since opening the shop, have read a whole lot about.
Hmm.
And it's certainly, if we're talking about the kind of historic threads and lineages of the Western ceremonial traditions up through chaos magic, I think it is one of the longest, relatively unbroken threads there. You have alchemical texts written today that are still citing things back in the Middle Ages, Dark Ages, or earlier. So it's an area of a very active and sort of very extensive scholarship, generally speaking. I find it also interesting because it is not alone in this, but one of the good examples of an area of the esoteric in which people approach it from radically different angles and very different ways. You have, in the modern era, people who approach alchemy as a purely metaphorical exercise and come at the body of work and body of texts there from the viewpoint that this is all about sort of the meditative mental practice of turning lead in the most abstract sense into gold in the most abstract sense as a purely sort of internal meditative spiritual practice. And on the other sort of edge of the extreme, and this is, I think, the one that most people are kind of popularly familiar with, is the image of, you know, the medieval alchemist trying to turn literal physical lead into literal physical gold. And because of that dichotomy, I think you end up with some very interesting debates that speak more broadly to what is the role of magic and the occult. Is this something that's just about sort of meditative self-improvement? Is this about, you know, operatively changing the world around us? And, you know, where do you sort of find, not even draw a line, but find a place within the balance between those two extremes?
Yeah.
And I think alchemy's had to deal with that question a little bit more so than some other traditions.
Where do you place that balance right now, knowing that this is, of course, an iterative process in all forms of human beings?
I think my favorite example of someone who I think has kind of found the right balance there is a scholar named Brian Cotnoir. He's written some fabulous texts. He recently did a retranslation of the Emerald Tablet from the original Arabic back to English, which is, as far as I know, sort of the most modern translation of that formative text. And his perspective is that, you know, I'd say falls somewhere kind of in the middle, but recognizing that both aspects of it are important. This idea that purely reading about or pondering or contemplating something is not sufficient, even if you believe this is primarily a meditative practice. That it is a meditative practice, you know, sort of like running or football is a meditative practice. It's not something that you can just read about and think about. It's something you do. And so if I'm paraphrasing his view on this correctly, as a way to get around to describing my own, I think I fall sort of in the same place of the acts and the sort of trappings and lab work that we talk about, you know, are important activities, whether or not they have any sort of chemical or physical value to them, because doing those acts is part of the meditative practice.
Fantastic. Thank you. Okay, next, randomly. Actually, do you want to be the one who's picking the... Oh, it's Juliet. I've got one. Okay, so I've written down, apparently, being a wizard all the time, ? And I think this is something that I wonder about with a lot of people who are involved in these sorts of things. Like, to what extent is magical practice and that sort of thing a separate part of your life and compartmentalized, or to what extent is it sort of like everything, every day, all the time? This could be a moment of ritual and wonder.
I'm trying very hard not to fire back with the question, well, it depends how you define ritual, because that's an awful non-answer, even if it, I think it's an important question.
I mean, you could, if you have more to say behind that, though, that would be a great answer.
That's what I'm sort of getting to, is if we're talking about, you know, sort of quote-unquote being a wizard all the time in the sense of robes and circles and spellcasting, I think that is by design very compartmentalized for most practitioners, simply because the majority of us have to exist in a mundane world in... at least in some aspects of our life, if not most of them.
Right.
Even these sort of relatively privileged practitioners who can, you know, disappear to their private retreat and
their hermitage.
Right, their hermitage and escape the regular world for a long period of time, that is still compartmentalized from mundane existence. So in that sense, I think it's a very kind of formal, sharp line, and that, you know, I would point to that as one of the benefits of what various traditions will call casting the circle or banishing the space, those sort of preparatory pre-steps to any sort of ritual work. It's very much about moving into the different compartment of mindset.
Mm.
That said, I think like any belief or practice or thing that one steeps themselves in for any period of time, I don't think it's really practical to think of that as truly compartmentalized. The ideas and beliefs and sort of principles and philosophies that undergird that compartmentalized practice certainly permeate out into one's wider existence.
Okay. Do you ever... I hesitate to ask this, so feel free to do a blanket, I refuse to comment.
Sure, go for it.
But, I mean, do you ever incorporate spellcasting ritual, anything of that sort, even things even vaguely to that sort, like in questions of professional settings? Like, have you ever tried to aid yourself in your lawyering with magic?
So this is something I get into a bit in the Know Your Rights, R-A-T-E-S, okay. talk, because I think there are some interesting parallels, but nothing quite so... on a significantly more subtle level than okay. that. I think, you know, when I...
You're not making poppets of...
Not so much poppets.
Yeah, okay.
But am I looking at a certain case with the question of, you know, what archetypes and what myths and what narratives are at play here? Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Because that is, you know, a fairly core part of any sort of litigation matter is this question of, you know, what's the story we're telling and how do we tell it?
Okay, great. That's, Actually, speaking of know your rights as a talk, you mentioned in the description thereof this question of like when the law and magic or ritual or the occult have sort of butted heads. And I was curious, what are some examples of that? This is sort of a bit of a sidetrack.
Sure.
But I was just personally curious, and since I have you here in the chair, what are some good examples of that?
So there's a couple that I reference in the full talk. I'll go into each of them briefly here because they're two fun examples.
Cool.
Probably the best known example is a case called Stembovsky v. Ackley, and this was a case based out of a sale of a home up in Nyack, New York, about in 45 minutes north of the city.
Oh, we talked about this in the show once.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
So it's a haunted house case.
Yeah, yeah.
And the sort of 2 seconds, the 30-second story is defendant sells their house. Plaintiff learns after moving in that the reason it was such a good deal is because it is notoriously haunted. And long story short, in an opinion rife with groan-inducing ghost puns,
yeah.
The court delivers the opinion that essentially... On one hand, we're not going to place the risk on the buyer and force them to, you know, contract out to a professional ghost hunter to figure out if a house is haunted or not. But we're also not going to make any specific determination on the existence or non-existence of phantoms. What we're going to do, the court says, is taking a look at the fact that the seller went around and promoted the house's haunted status to people in the town, to a book that was sort of cataloging haunted places in the U.S. You know, they'd sort of taken active steps to make it known that the house was haunted. And the court says because of that, the duty of disclosure falls on the seller. Not because it was in fact haunted, the court doesn't touch that.
Right.
But because the reputation was something that the seller created. Mm. And The other example is a little more recent. In one of the city council elections in the city, and I'm forgetting the names of the two parties here, but there was a mural that went up outside the residence or sort of within view of the residence of the competing candidate, not the incumbent.
Okay.
And the mural portrayed a chicken head and a number of other elements that this candidate read as symbols related to a sort of root work curse.
Hmm.
And so they brought and this mural had been not commissioned necessarily, but permitted, encouraged, requested by the incumbent candidate.
Okay, so they were an active participant to some extent.
To some extent. I forget the exact extent right now.
Okay.
So the aspiring candidate brought a lawsuit claiming, among other things, that this was an attempt to curse her during the campaign. And again, in sort of an end run around the difficult question of is this real or not, the complaint made that an issue in an emotional distress claim.
Okay.
So it's not, you literally cursed me and I was harmed by it. It was, this looked like a curse to me based on the imagery within it, and that caused me, that intentionally caused me emotional distress that harmed me in a different way.
Okay.
So the sort of long and short theme in all the cases I'm aware of where the courts have had to confront the supernatural in some way or another,
right,
has been this resolution of, well, we don't want to get into that, but let's look at the most tangible, most objective things possible and the effects that this sort of numinous thing had.
That's really, it's interesting because I feel like America is a strange country in so much, well, in a lot of ways.
Many ways.
Oppressively so. But like one of the ways in which it is strange is this way that we, I think, claim, at least at an ideological level, that we are based on a kind of empirical enlightenment background, but are still very unwilling to let go of forms of mysticism, primarily Judeo-Christian, but like this idea of like, you know, why can't we have the Ten Commandments in the courthouse? And for the courts to avoid this so thoroughly fascinates me. I mean, especially because like there was like that, there's a Supreme Court case, I think in the 20s, where someone murdered a woman because they were convinced that she was hexing them. And the court, and his defense was, this was self-defense because I was getting hexed.
Oh, interesting. That one I'm not familiar with.
I need to find it again because I don't actually remember. I believe it was 1921. That's the one thing that my mind can really hold on to. And I think they tried to make an appeal to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court refused to look at it.
Right.
On the grounds that this was not enough to merit a self-defense.
Interesting.
Argument. But, okay, so moving on to our continual randomization of the... So two things, two particular rituals, one of which I'm not actually sure you did. There's a rumor I heard of someone doing this, and I thought it was you, and I did not have time to ask you if this was you, so you can deny this.
I don't know if I'm more fascinated if this was or wasn't me.
So I'm led to understand that someone, who may or may not have been you, recorded the name of every demon in the Ars Goetia, superimposed all those sounds on top of each other, put them on a cassette tape, and put that in a bank to curse the bank. Was that you?
You know, it wasn't, but that's such a good rumor, I almost don't want to deny it.
Okay, so...
That definitely was not me, but that's delightful.
For the record, Fred Jennings refused to deny that he was the one who did that elaborate demon cassette tape that I just described. Okay, but here's one that I'm sure you did, because you mentioned it to me. You recently did a number of... A certain amount of ritual work with the subway as sort of the...
Oh, yes.
The sort of deity force that you were sort of working with. Can you talk a little bit about that and just sort of like the mindset behind it and like what you were trying to accomplish, how it worked?
Yeah. So one of the biggest adjustments for me in my sort of spiritual practice upon coming to the city, I grew up in a very small town, basically out in the woods and near the water. And so adjusting to from a practice I developed in that space to living in New York City was a big change. And I think a degree of sort of animism has always been a part of my practice. Mm. And the kind of broad scope project that I've sort of been on a kick about for a long time in one way or another is finding ways to incorporate that kind of animism into a spiritual engagement with the city as an entity. So the subway thing was something that I was doing most seriously, probably two or three years ago now, remains sort of in the margins of my projects I mean to come back to and, you know, get sort of more serious about again. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a... I don't have any like specific really exciting ritual stories about it. It was more a series of kind of ritualistic engagements with different subway lines.
Okay, so what's an example of, say, did you do anything with the J, and if so, what?
No, I didn't.
Harsh.
Yeah, sorry, J.
So what is one example of something you did with a particular train?
A lot of it in that sort of animistic practice was about devotion and communication.
Okay.
It's that kind of opening the lines of communication to kind of interact with something spiritually.
Okay.
And so it was mostly contemplative and devotional practice during sort of quiet moments on a certain subway line or another.
Mm. Okay. You know, it's interesting. I mean, the subway feels like the beating heart of the city in a lot of ways.
That's why I was interested in it, because it's such a fundamental part of the sort of geography and both social and physical structure here.
Yeah. And it's, like, as much as I try not to like look for signs and things, I feel like that's a way of getting trapped in your own schizophrenia a little bit. I do often feel that like when I walk into the subway and the train immediately arrives, that is a sign that I'm more sort of in tune with the universe.
Right. No, I think many New Yorkers have that kind of synchronistic belief about whether you make the train or not.
Yeah. To steal a term, it does make you feel more like you're in the pocket,
right,
so to speak. Okay. So this next thing I just picked up. Oh, I should mention, since we're at the halfway point, hey, everybody, you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. It's a radio station. You're listening to it right now. I'm sorry if this is surprising. Okay. So the next thing I just picked up, labels. Which, I mean, so I've heard you called a chaos magician. I've heard you called an alchemist. You might be a Thelemite secretly or not secretly. Are there any labels that you feel like are properly attached to you? And or do you just reject labels entirely? What are labels? What is nominalism? Is it a crutch? Is it a method to power?
I'd argue it's both.
Ooh, go, please.
All right. So I think labels are tricky with the spiritual, because unless you are someone who has an extremely specific practice or an extremely specific scholarship, they carry with them an image that is not necessarily, almost by definition, not the person's whole.
Right.
I'm curious who's calling me an alchemist, because I don't think I've ever identified
this
that
way. This is the thing I keep seeing. Okay, maybe, I mean, this might be like the subway tape thing, or not the demon tape thing, where right. I'm certain it happened and it actually is a completely false memory.
Entirely possible.
Maybe I should quit drinking. I don't know. But like
mysteries. So I typically describe myself as a chaos magician, because that is kind of the easiest and least crutchily defining shorthand.
Mm.
But that gets into the question of, well, what does that label mean? And that's the trickier part, where I think the label becomes sort of more harm than good.
Yeah.
Certainly the you've had public appearances of chaos magic in certain circles, where I think it's sometimes rightfully kind of looked down upon by certain more scholarly traditions. And there is, you know, I think much as Thelemites often misinterpret or oversimplify the notion of do what thou wilt.
Yeah.
I think chaos magicians are equally guilty as a general community of misinterpreting that notion of nothing's true, everything is permitted.
Mm.
Both in their own way, on a very superficial level, can be read, or I should say can be, in my opinion, misread as a sort of hyper-individualistic grant of authority to do anything you want.
Right, right.
And I think on a deeper level, both of those phrases do not mean that. But that doesn't change the potential misapplication by people wearing those labels.
Right.
So I think that the tricky place with a label is it makes you both an authority and a diplomat for what that label means.
Mm.
And those are not small roles, and not ones I'm eager to take on with really any particular label.
Entirely fair. How do you feel about the use of labels in ritual? Because you were talking earlier about archetypes and the ritual use thereof, and that idea of like perhaps donning a label temporarily to embody something and therefore draw its power or become more, you know, to press up to the form of the thing with all of your contours. Mm-hmm. Is this a useful thing?
I think in ritual it's an incredibly useful thing. I mean, what begins an invocation if not the taking on of a series of labels?
Mm.
I think it can be incredibly helpful, but I think I get a little bit back to what we were saying before about compartmentalization.
Yeah.
Within the context of a ritual, which is intentionally drawing on archetypal labels and notions, or intentionally drawing on particular deities or planets or sort of roles within the defined ritual space, those are incredibly important things. The tricky part, where that can become a crutch or a hindrance, or you know, or a sort of binding restriction is when those labels bleed out into one's non-ritual spaces.
Right. It's funny when one of my introductions to magic, particularly chaos magic, was Philip J. Carroll's Libernal and Psychonaut. And as I was reading the section where he talks about the idea of randomizing your personality to some extent and sort of taking on a number of archetypal forms in your life and committing them completely, it kind of occurred to me, this is how you stop having friends. This is how you sort of alienate everyone around you a little bit.
Oh my, yes. And I've known several of that chaos magician who took that advice as a important enough practice to sacrifice basically their entire social life for a period of time.
And I wonder, clearly the way you're phrasing, you are hesitant to do such a thing, and I am hesitant to do such a thing because I like my friends.
Right.
And I know that there is value in alienation as someone who spent, this is about you, this isn't about me, but I spent 6 months in China completely isolated basically from everyone and everything, and it changed me in ways that were both good and bad.
But the hermit card is not in the major arcana by coincidence.
Exactly.
An important part of that sort of mythic arc.
But I guess that's the sort of thing is all things are temporary, but some things should be more temporary than others.
I'd agree with that statement. I think where I go with that piece of Carol's advice is that absolutely, that type of mental exercise is a useful way to develop the sort of paradigmatic flexibility that chaos magic draws on, cultivating that ability to put on or take off a certain set of beliefs and thoughts and sort of thought systems is absolutely useful. I think the problem with taking Carol's advice literally on that is you're exactly right. It is incredibly alienating and or a great excuse for terrible behavior, which is not to say the mental exercise of it isn't useful. So I think it is about finding those sort of moments of hermitage in which there is a safe non-social space to try that out.
It's interesting because when I look at the negative consequences of people becoming magicians of one form or another, they often do come with it's always the question of license. Mm-hmm. I know I say this wrong, but I say it the Black Sabbath way, and I will not apologize for that. When Crowley was destructive to people around him for somewhat ritualistic aspects, so I think part of that was just his own desire for power. I think part of that came from the self-licensing of Thelema. And I actually once was curious about occultists and politics, who is an open occultist, pagan, spiritualist, what have you, in the U.S. political system. And I was only able to find two people, one of which was a Thelemite in Florida who was running for local elections and was also a white supremacist. And the idea of this grasping for power, I can see where this idea of self-license can be so
popular.
Wait,
who was the other one, though?
There was a state senator in New York who basically was open about his belief in Norse paganism. Once again, white supremacist. Oddly running theme, but that's two people. That's not enough data points for any kind of real theme.
Also, if you're looking at people with a more healthy degree of desire for power or not, politics may be a tough place to find that.
Right. I mean, anyone who goes deep enough into politics must be some sort of, I think, deeply damaged individual. I don't mean to generalize. It's just, why? Why would you? But okay, so I've got student versus practitioner, but we talked about that. Problems, I wrote these myself, so they're not going to be surprising to me. Thelema, fun. Thelema, hey.
Sure, let's talk about that.
Because I know you've been reading.
I've been on a big Thelema reading kick lately.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not the first one, not the first time I've kicked that ball down the road. Mm. I think some of the original writers, Phil Hine and Peter Carroll among them, in Chaos Magic, recognize that a lot of what formed the sort of basis of Chaos Magic came out of Thelema.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much that gets reflected in sort of more modern writing on the subject, but I think it's undeniable that Chaos Magic gets its start in a lot of the core concepts of Thelema.
Right.
This idea of the aim of science, or the aim of religion, the method of science, is very much present there in Chaos Magic as well. And so, and additionally, a lot of these sort of ritual structures that you will read about in Carroll's or Hine's work the structure itself, not the specifics, but the overall process is lifted almost directly from Thelema or from the Golden Dawn by way of Thelema. So yeah. there's a very strong connection there. I think also in terms of the Western ceremonial traditions, there's just more and better scholarship out there on Thelemic practices, and a lot of which Thelema itself borrowed from Golden Dawn and other sort of slightly older but coexistent Western traditions.
Right.
So I think a lot of it is that there is an important knowledge base there, and there's also a pretty widely written and researched set of correspondences and associations there. I was talking earlier about the way that alchemy has that like relatively unbroken sort of scholarly line. And certainly Thelema doesn't have that, but by way of hopping from, you know, by sort of looking backwards from Thelema through to the Golden Dawn practices, through to the sort of older hermetic and alchemical practices that those traditions were sort of brought up out of, you have a less broken line than some other traditions.
Definitely. I mean, like also just the idea of like knowing that we can place this tradition firmly, at least initially, in the body of a single individual and watching their development, like really is a good linkage, just because people existed in time and space and they are physical entities. And I'm kind of going too far with that. Found in Catland, already did it. Where is home, magically speaking?
That's
an open-ended question that I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not going to try to clarify that. I think it's more interesting.
That's way more interesting. Unqualified and unclarified. Yeah. So especially with a label of chaos magic, it's difficult to say, like, here specifically as home, because a significant part of that practice is about, you know, sort of the syncretic method and bringing multiple and sometimes even discordant practices and beliefs into a common space. I do think the notion of sort of a quote unquote home, spiritually speaking, there is very important. In addition to the this is licensed to be a total jerk, the other, I think, important criticism of chaos magic is that the line between syncretism and appropriation is extremely fuzzy.
Ooh, yes.
And so the question, I think it's a question that I see more and more chaos magicians asking in community spaces of, you know, what is home in the sense of where do I pull from? Mm-hmm. Where do I look to for ritual inspiration, for sort of the mechanisms and details of creating a ritual. And so I identify that with the things that I was sort of first introduced to, or that I have read most thoroughly about and sort of spent the most time engaging with. So speaking of Thelema, a lot of that ends up being that, largely because that was, you know, some of the first texts I read were based in Thelemic and sort of older sort of Western ceremonial tradition practices. And so that has that sort of home feeling. I also mentioned animism, and so growing up in a place that was kind of out in the woods and having that kind of very earthy, more like it's a sort of more stereotypically pagan practice at an earlier point in life, also informed a lot of, you know, sort of what feels like sort of my ritual comfort zone these days.
Though it is fun to see you transfer that animism from, you know, traditionally understood nature to the nature that is New York, which is basically trains and...
Right. I mean, I think that's sort of where the chaos magic concept comes in. You have people like Grant Morrison talking about the idea of working with comic book heroes as deities.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of thing, just with a pagan bent to it.
Totally. I mean, sacrificial acid and trying to summon John Lennon and all that. Yeah. Okay, cool. Actually, Grant Morrison, what are your thoughts on that feller there? Have you strong Grant Morrison thoughts? It's okay if no.
I don't have strong Grant Morrison conclusions, but certainly thoughts, yeah. I'm a huge fan of his work. I think if I were going to point someone to a casual, readable sort of intro to chaos magic, The Invisibles though dated, is certainly a good reference and I think a good sort of cultural introduction.
Okay, so that actually ties into one of the next cards I just pulled, which is great. So, because The Invisibles, for those of you who don't know, was essentially ripped off and made into The Matrix, which, you know, they replaced magic with digital robots and so on. And so you made a Chrome extension once that automatically would convert the word digital native to Indigo Children. And while I'm curious to hear you talk about that in particular, also this it brings up this larger question of magic within digital spaces. And I don't know, like, jumping off point, Chrome extension, lovely thing, just downloaded it myself.
Oh, fun.
But yeah, where did this come from?
So that Chrome extension was a, like, 30 minutes to an hour evening project based on a friend's sort of tongue-in-cheek suggestion of reading those two things with a similar degree of woo-wery to them. And I think there's a lot of overlap in the way that we talk about or interact with technology today, with the exception of the people who are, you know, highly technical and building these pieces of technology. There is a sense to ascribe sort of a magical power to them. I think one of my favorite examples, in part because of my work, is the way that people write about hackers or people, you know, doing things creatively with technology that may not have been intended.
Yeah.
A lot of the rhetoric reads very similar to the way that people talked about witches back in the Middle Ages.
Oh yeah. They have access to the language that is at the foundation of the universe.
Right, exactly. And that is both powerful and scary.
I think deeply so. Have you done anything in terms of like digital sigils or anything along those lines?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, like every chaos magician with an internet, you know, I've seen the like sigil posting groups around, and I've certainly taken part in sort of distributed ritual that involved, you know, sort of agreed upon times with people working in different locations and sort of emailing of files around. But in terms of, I don't know, it's the short answer is no.
Okay. But, okay, so another card that I pulled up around the time I pulled up that one about the Chrome extension, which, by the way, get it, just do it, come on, life's too short not to have that Chrome extension. So magic and activism. Mm-hmm. This is a very rich topic, so I'm glad we got to it before the end of the show, which is coming up in about 11 and a half minutes. But, like, where do you see these two things drawing? I don't want to like, because we talked about this before in an interview I did for a different podcast that hasn't actually started yet. Heads up, everybody. But like, just like magic and ritual. I mean, you've given talks about this. You are clearly interested in both. I mean, you were doing that work in Palestine not too long ago. What role do you see for magic in activism and liberating people and so on?
The place I go with that is sort of similar to what I was saying before in response to your question about, you know, how, if at all, does this sort of magical side of one's practice work into that sort of mundane professional world? And I think that the strongest common theme I see with a magical practice and an activist practice is both are about stories and power. The question of what is an effective message for a political campaign, or what is the, you know, the right chant or the right place for this marching demonstration. Those are, at the end of the day, mythical questions. It's this question of what story are we telling and how do people take it up? You know, your goal in most activism in the sort of abstract sense is to create some sort of tangible change through voice and action. And, you know, I don't think it's sort of that one-to-one simple kind of vulgar parallel where, you know, it is identical to people doing ritual work. It is, I think, intentionally much more on the ground and engaged rather than apart from the mundane world. But I think the themes of, you know, planning out, well, what archetypes are involved here? What is the symbolism of what's being done? Is at its heart a very esoteric question.
Mm. Who is us? Who is them?
Right. Who is us? Who is them? Who is good? Who is bad? What is the right thing to be doing here? I think that's sort of where I locate that parallel. I think it's a more productive way of thinking about how to do activism in the face of, you know, what we were talking about earlier with this kind of veneer of secularism on much of society. There's this sort of idea of, you know, the rational actor who's planned things out in this very mundane sense, which, you know, I think we've seen in many recent political moments, the power of people's sort of emotional force and those sort of narratives is much greater than, you know, a lengthy, well-written objective analysis of what should be done.
Yeah. People hear the shouting, they never read the platform.
Precisely, right. What falls flat and what is picked up and internalized is a question that is much more abstract than which is objectively the better choice.
Mm. That is also interesting. Like the emotional content of like so much of our society, I think, has been sublimated, which makes it all the more powerful. Like the question of just like even advertising culture, upon which so much of our lives now rests because of these sort of things you don't pay for, but you are now the product being sold. That question of our fear. I don't know. Sorry. I'm getting vague now.
Do you have another question?
I have like three more of these left. But if you want to say a thing, please do.
Oh, I was going to say, I don't know that I quite answered your Grant Morrison question. We got on.
Oh, yeah. Because I got excited about the Chrome extension.
Yeah.
Which is good. Do it, guys. But yeah, please, Grant Morrison, go. Please.
So I think The Invisibles is a fantastic bit of work. Reading Morrison's take on the sort of what he calls the hypersigil process of creating this work is a sort of wonderful reflection on sort of the practice of sigils in a chaos magic tradition. I think, you know, one of the things that I struggle with as a kind of broad form question about the occult in general is, when, if ever, is a barrier to entry desirable?
Interesting.
Should a gate be kept at all? And chaos magic in general, I think, takes the view of no, really, almost never should there be, you know, something that separates the access of to this knowledge and practice from anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I think with Grant's work and Grant's work specifically kind of promoting some of the practices of chaos magic, the only thing that gives me pause or wonder about it is approaching something purely from practice without any reflection on sort of the principles or ideas underneath that practice.
Yeah.
I don't think is the most effective way to go about it.
Mm.
And so as sort of a gateway to chaos magic, I think Grant has done some absolutely fantastic work and absolutely important work. What I'm curious about and would love to know better is how many of the people who've walked through that gateway have gone on to, you know, sort of dive deeper into the study of that and, you know, getting into more of the principles and ideas more than just the sort of simplistic practice.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because I was recently watching a talk given by Ramsey Dukes, where he was describing the sort of the nature of, especially things like the OTO, where you have this combination of sort of mystery traditions and sort of the hermetic notion of like how you can actually make a thing happen or not. And so like there's this idea that like the barriers set up there, which I had always sort of bristled at, as like, this is a way of maintaining power over other people. This is a way of setting up a hierarchical society. This is terrible. Like, when viewed through the lens that he was trying to put forth, that like, maybe this is just the idea that they want you to spend a lot of time self-cultivating before they give you the technologies of magic. Like, there's some value in that, I suppose.
Right. I mean, I think the tricky thing is, it is, or at least it can be, both or either of those.
Okay, so what does move along to? I've written the word altars with an exclamation point, a question mark, and then a second exclamation point. Altars! Wait, how do I actually do it? Altars? Okay, that's a more accurate, I think, pronunciation of that. Altars. Your thoughts. Do you use them? Have you used them? Is there one right now somewhere in your house?
There is. There are probably a couple, technically speaking. Unless the cats destroyed that other one.
They do like to knock things off of things.
They do, though. You know, speaking of the timing of the subway is another sort of little synchronicities in one's life. That's another place that I feel is fairly safe to at least entertain.
Yeah.
I find altars very useful for a lot of the same reasons that I find those sort of ritual preparatory works useful. It delineates that space, that compartment between mundane and sort of magical realities. The altar is I've always found altars a sort of useful space to come to as a what's the way to put it?
The altar alters you a little bit.
The altar alters you, but it also gives you a distinct and discrete space where that takes place. Mm. I'm inclined to agree with you that sort of unfettered mystical engagement with reality is a road or either a roadway to that sort of schizoid engagement with the world or at least practically indistinguishable from it.
Yeah.
So I think much like drawing compartments between ritual work and daily life, the altar as a confined space is a similar sort of compartment exercise. You know, here are the mythopoeic aspects that I want present in my daily life.
Right. Do you have any advice for people who are looking to, because I think altar building is something that like a lot of people do, but not a lot of people actually talk about in terms of like just general like how to's for people. I personally don't, I'm starting to cultivate one now that I have some bones in my possession, which is just, I mean, bones, they creep me out, which means I'm perfect for this sort of thing. But like, what's some good advice to somebody who wants to go into altering?
I'm going to circle back quickly to what you were saying about looking at the sort of hierarchical system of the OTO.
Yeah.
I think it is some hierarchical gatekeeping nonsense to say that there is a specific single right way to do or wrong way to do an altar.
Awesome. Love it.
And I think the synthesis between the notion of you've got to reflect in order to do this correctly.
Yeah.
And no one should be telling you how to do this in a sort of canonical orthodox way.
Yeah.
I think the synthesis of those two ideas, for me at least, is I think practice predates the altar.
Okay.
Do some work and get some, you know, sort of get familiar with your own traditions first and build whatever altar sort of feels right through that. You know, if you think of an altar at its most general as you are creating an intentional magical space, you know, sort of that almost psychogeographical question of where do things go within this space to feel right?
Right.
To feel like what I want it to accomplish. I think that's the guidepost.
Okay.
And from there, you know, it's all that question of, you know, you go back to the traditions you work with, you go back to the symbol sets and associations that you sort of resonate with and identify with and build from there.
That's fantastic. And I think we're basically at the end of our time. So Fred, thank you so much for coming on today. And if there's anything you want to, actually we're at the last 30 seconds. So keep listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. And is there any advice you would give to anybody who wants to do anything or any like last moments or thoughts that you want to get out?
No, just thank you for having me. It was a pleasure being here.
Fantastic. Well, then stay tuned, everybody, and stay as witchy as possible.